There it is again, that matrix. It tells you the coefficients of the transitions between the different mass eigenstates and the weak eigenstates. And so you can define, this is a unitarity matrix, just like the CKM matrix. You can define some angles. There are three angles, C12, which is theta 12, which is, as you see, the angle between the first generation, second generation, theta 13, and theta 23. So there's three angles, and there's a CP phase, CP violating phase. So you know about quark mixing and things like that. You have, just like in like a B meson system or the kaon system, K0 system, you can have oscillations as these things travel through space. And so that means a new E, for instance, if it's generated, you know, at t equals zero, can turn into a new mu or a new tau as you go time. And this is the oscillation probability over distance L for new alpha to new beta, two things going in. And it depends on combinations of these terms here, depending on what alpha and beta is, and the mass difference between these two. So there has to be a mass difference. And the distance, L, that you are away from the production, and the energy. So it's L over E. So in the two flavor approximation, so this is the three, this is the full mixing probability equation. If you say that, if you ignore the third flavor and you say, okay, I'm only going to look at mixing between, you know, state A and state B, this is the two flavor approximation right here. So it depends on sine squared theta. So these are these, you know, the thetas that come up here. The C here means cosine, the S here means sine. This is sine squared 2 theta. So if you're looking at electrons and muons, electrons go to muons, this would be theta 12, the first two generations, times sine squared, some number comes from somewhere, delta M squared, the mass difference between nu 1 and nu 2, L over E. The key experimental parameter here is L over E. Make sense? Everyone clear so far? Yes, sir. Nope, I will not. Okay, so how do we know they have mass? Well, some history here. We already discussed this a little bit. There was a solar neutrino anomaly that was around for a long time. And some people were thinking, you know, the theory of neutrino mixing, you know, was developed long before that, sort of in the late 70s, early 80s. People said that if neutrinos have mass, they will mix like this. But there was no evidence for it. There was this solar neutrino problem, but it was very controversial what was due. Did we really understand what happens in the sun? But then an experiment in Japan, Japan's right there. I did this on Google Earth. I made Japan at the top just so I could make a nice picture. I honestly did. This was probably the most artistic thing I did for these set of talks. They looked at cosmic rays, which are mostly protons, tens of GeV. They come in, they shower, they produce lots of pions, which produce muons. And they looked at neutrinos. So these are mostly muon neutrinos coming through here. There's some electron neutrinos, but mostly muon neutrinos. Say they looked at a big water Cherenkov detector, looking at neutrinos coming, just neutrinos in their detector. But they can also do some pointing. So they said, okay, if the angle that the neutrino makes if the neutrino comes from the sky, that's cosine theta of 1. If the cosine theta came from underneath, that's cosine theta of -1. And they saw, if they were just from what they would expect, if there was no oscillation, they'd expect a distribution like this. That's no oscillation. But what they actually measured was a distribution like this, the data points here, which basically says that neutrinos going through the Earth, muon neutrinos through the Earth, they're a lot less than they expected. Now, neutrino doesn't interact in the Earth very often. I mean, the probability for it to interact in the Earth is roughly zero. So they're not losing neutrinos that way. They're losing neutrinos because they're turning into something else. That was the conclusion. This basically, since the theory had been out there, that was basically the conclusion to this. We're actually seeing neutrino oscillations. You can't see neutrino oscillations unless they have mass.
One quick comment?
Yeah.
Pretty much have to at this point.
Okay.
So I think it's, do you all know why it's only muon neutrinos that are coming from the atmosphere? So if you don't know why, it's a very, very good exercise in computation of the decay amplitude to figure out why the pions pretty much only decay to muons rather than electrons. There is a very simple and deep reason for it, and it governs this entire thing. And the reason why we have pions in the atmosphere is, of course, just because you bombard the nuclei and that's what you see. But the reason why pions decay to muons and neutrino muons is very...
Right. That's a good point.
So, exercise for the weekend.
Yes.
I strongly encourage it. That's a very... And it's also the basis, by the way, for all the neutrino beams that are being designed these days.
I mean, almost all of our neutrino beams come from producing pions. Yes, you're first.
What's the theta angle?
The theta angle is the zenith angle. So one is it came from the sky. So downward going is cosine theta of one. Upward going from the respect to the detector is cosine theta minus one. And that gets zero then is sort of coming across. But there's sort of, you know, we're getting the cosmic ray distribution is fairly well uniform. There's one more question.
Is that sign asymmetry the plot between plus and minus one just a statistics thing, or is there actually some effect which causes up and down to go between those two the expected numbers of parts?
Which asymmetry?
The minus one is slightly higher than plus one, I
guess. Oh, right here? The data in the green?
On the red line. Why you want one plus one?
Oh, this symmetry this between this and this?
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it really? I can't really tell. Maybe a little bit. Yeah. I'm not sure about that. Okay, so this was fairly convincing for everyone back in the day. And then another experiment called SNOW. That's at SNOW Lab. It's very close to here, right? It's very close to here?
Yeah. Well, far away.
That's very close. Canada's a big country. So they were looking at neutrinos from the sun. And the energy spectrum of neutrinos from the sun is very much softer than neutrinos from cosmic rays. They were looking at neutrinos about 10 MeV. And the sun's a long ways away, a lot further than, you know, the top of the atmosphere. So this is a very much different L over E. And they saw a deficit of electron neutrinos. Basically, the sun only produces electron neutrinos. The nuclear reactions just doesn't have enough to produce muon or tau neutrinos. And so what they expected was something. I mean, here's the expectation. They got it from normalizing the flux from Super K, the Japanese experiment. And what they saw was something like this. And so this is a big deficit here. And this was quickly realized that this is another mixing angle. This is another evidence for. This is more evidence for neutrino oscillations, but this time with a different. Delta M squared and theta 1 2. So these both of these they use the two flavor approximation. So for the muon neutrinos it was muon oscillating into nu tau because they weren't seeing the new E. For the solar neutrinos it was nu E oscillating into nu mu. Or 1 2. I mean they call it 1 2 1 3, but that's basically what they're seeing at the detectors. So we have basically. Here's your picture. You've got your three neutrinos, three masses, M1, M2, M3. And nu 1 is made of some fraction of nu E, some fraction of nu mu, which is blue, some fraction of nu tau. Disregard the purple. Nu 2 is sort of you know evenly distributed, and nu 3 is something like this, so more nu mu and nu tau. That's the idea. They measure mass splitting, so mass M1 and M2 were measured, M2 and M3 were measured. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay, so now what? Once you say they have mass, there's a lot of different things you could do. It's like thing. So first of all, if they have mass, they have this mixing. Is there CP violation in that neutrino sector? That's a good question. Are there right-handed neutrinos? There should be. Why not? I don't know. Are there more than three flavors? That's, you know, same with the question of quark families. Are there more than three flavors of quarks? Are there more than families of quarks? Are there more than three families of leptons? How much mass do they have? We measured mass splittings. We sort of know that neutrinos are pretty light, how light is pretty light? And why are they so light? What's the kind of mass? Is it Majorana or Dirac? That's sort of the same question. Or how do they get mass? I mean, that's a related question. And could neutrinos be the solution to the dark matter puzzle? I'm not gonna talk about this at all, but it is a question that came up, that comes up, and the answer still could be yes, okay? So for these first three or four questions, the best way to answer that question is determine the PM and S matrix. And you can do that with oscillation experiments, okay? So this is where we are with the matrix today. These are just the amplitudes of the matrix elements. Contrast this with the CKM matrix, which is almost diagonal with very small off-diagonal terms. This is close to what they call maximal mixing. What that means, nobody knows. Does it mean anything? Maybe not. But you know, people try to read the tea leaves and things, and maybe that has some. You can get some insight into the deeper physics.
Means.
Come on.
They don't know why.
Yes, you know the definition of the term, I guess. But and so this table here just shows a comparison of the PM and S matrix and the CKM matrix. It's pretty different. You know, delta CP. This is delta CP from the CKM matrix, known to about 5 degrees, and I talked about that, and I didn't necessarily couch it in terms of delta CP, but this is related to alpha, beta, gamma. We don't know this at all, and this is the next thing that we really need to hammer down. The other thing we don't know is the order of these delta M squareds. But before I talk about that, we measured theta 1, 2, we measured theta 2, 3 very early on. Theta 1-3 actually just recently came around. The Diabay reactor experiment is basically a set of scintillator tubs situated around at different distances from this reactor complex. And so the energy of the neutrinos coming out of the reactor, anti-neutrino, electron neutrinos, is about MeV. The scale here is a few kilometers. And so this is a different L over E regime. And so the survival probability can be calculated like this, related to sine squared theta 1-3, and then also this delta M squared 3-1, which you can just sort of rearrange. You actually know what this is. This is just a rearrangement of 2-1 and 2-3. Okay. And this, I should say, when you see this delta M 3-1 or delta M squared anything, the delta M actually can have a sign. It's not delta. It's delta M squared has a sign. It's an assign we don't know, but it can be positive or negative. It's not a squared quantity. It's a difference between squares. Yes, sir.
Is the 3-1 mass predetermined from the 1-2 and 2-3 because you don't know whether the 3 is between the 1 and 2 or outside it?
Oh, that's true. Yes, there are two. That's right. There's two. Yes, that's correct. Good point. Thank you. I said that incorrectly. Okay. So what they did was they had these different detectors at different baselines, and they measured the electron anti-neutrino disappearance. So they basically used the near detectors to normalize the flux of the neutrinos, and then they looked at the far detectors and saw that they saw fewer neutrinos. That's evidence for oscillation into something else. And you see it here. This is the energy spectrum, not of the neutrino, but actually of the energy that they saw. And they saw this deficit here that's very clear. And so this was the first determination of this angle. And this was, well, I have a plot right here. This was about 5 years ago or so that they first start to get real evidence, 3 years. And so this is where we are now. So that was Daya Bay. There was another experiment in Korea, very similar. They were just a little bit slower. But they saw, they quickly had a result out that came, that was in good agreement with that result. And now it's actually very well measured. It's actually, I think, the best, the most well measured angle there is in the PM&S, or in the neutrino mixing paradigm. So that's good. So we do not know the mass hierarchy. So we don't know whether the normal hierarchy is typically labeled with the one that's most nu tau and nu mu. And so the high, the M3 is the sort of the heaviest one, and M1 is the lightest one, the nu E, the one that's most nu E, but it could be flipped. And so we don't actually know this yet. And that's gonna have different, and this normal hierarchy and the inverted hierarchy give different patterns of oscillation. Okay, and we'll talk about that in a second. So this is a big question too. Yes?
Is the muon neutrino mass necessarily in between
the atoms? The muon neutrino, no, no, not at all. Muon neutrino doesn't have a well-defined mass. It's the ones with well-defined masses have are M1, M2, M3, right? Those are the mass eigenstates.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I mean, so with the analogy of the electron, muon, and tau, we put those in normal order in masses, electron, muon, tau. And so that's sort of this order. Most nu tau, most nu mu, most nu e. That's normal. Inverted is mixed up. Yes, sir?
Maybe make one comment you about can, the 1-3.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a pretty big thing to measure that for two reasons. First of all, there were a lot of models where theta 1-3 was basically zero because there is symmetry associated with it, that's the maximum mixing, and this just blew out of the water all those models. And it's not just that it's like maybe it's going to be a small perturbation. Actually, theta 1-3 is not small.
Right.
It's actually turned out to be pretty big.
Yeah.
So that sort of models is out. So it's in some sense even more confusing that structure right now.
Okay.
There is really that there really doesn't to be very, any kind of symmetry there that is.
Okay. So actually, one of the key things for measuring the mass hierarchy, and I'm not going to get into the math at all because I'm not going to get into it. I don't fully understand it. It's not that it's that complicated, but it just... So let's say you have neutrinos going through matter, like the Earth or the Sun. They'll interact, right? They interact. And so all flavors will do something like this as it goes through something with, let's say, electrons in it, like, you know, the Earth. And so I call this, you know, new X here is all flavors and anti-flavors. They'll do stuff like this, and that will have some effects. But nu E is special because there are electrons here. And so the nu E, as it travels through Earth, can see this reaction. So nu E comes in, charge current interaction with another electron, and you basically get this crossing here. And so there, depending on the density of the electrons of the material that you're going through, there's actually a resonance region for this forward scattering. And depending on the sign of this delta M squared 3-1, the oscillation probability is either enhanced or suppressed depending on the sign. And of course, it depends on how much matter you're going through. So it's good to have different baselines for your measurements so that you can measure better this mass hierarchy effect. Now it's hard because as you're gonna see, the CP violation effect on the oscillation parameters can sometimes look like a mass hierarchy effect, but we'll get into that in a second. But first, I'm going to talk about detectors and beams somewhat. Okay. So neutrino sources, very quickly. Solar neutrinos, we already talked about. They just come from the stuff going on in the sun, up to roughly 30 MeV. Only electron neutrinos are produced. Atmospheric, mostly 1 through 10, but it actually can go very, very high in all flavors, but a lot of muon neutrinos again. There are some, this is not terribly interesting for fundamental physics, but there are geologic neutrinos coming from nuclear processes in the Earth. They're typically very, there's not that many of them, and there are a few MeV. Supernova neutrinos, supernova burst neutrinos are actually very interesting. We can get a lot of information out of supernova bursts. You know, we're still milking from the supernova that happened in, what, 87? And a super Kamiokande saw like three of them or five of them or something. I mean, and so, but they're really interesting. And they I'm not going to talk about that, but that's like a really interesting topic. And then like real cosmic neutrinos, they go really, really high. Ice Cube has been looking at these recently. Well, they've been looking at it for a long time, but they just keep seeing more and more high energy neutrinos. From cosmic sources, not from cosmic rays, but actually from cosmic sources. Yes, sir.
What are the kind of sources that give off such high energy neutrinos?
I am not an expert. Do you know?
Well, the PEB.
Yeah.
I don't think people have a very good idea.
There are a lot of papers coming out.
Of dark matter, but I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But roughly, the things that create cosmic rays. So if you have a cosmic ray particle that has
right.
an interaction that produces a pion that then has a
UVK, yeah. That's right. I mean, you know, boosted, if things get boosted.
I think those estimates don't work out.
Sorry?
I don't think those sort of estimates work out to be correct for that kind of flexibility.
Okay, well, that's.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, you can imagine sources giving
you
yeah. one, but
I don't see the. Well, I don't think it's wrong by orders of magnitude. And B, there are just a couple of events. So we'll
yeah. And then, of course, there are man-made sources of this, nuclear reactors. We already talked a little bit about that. And then beams, I'm going to go into some detail. So this really goes with the detectors, but if you're going to detect neutrinos, they're, broadly speaking, two types of reaction, neutral current, charge current. Typically, you're going off a nucleon. Here I show protons, but basically with neutral current, nu comes in, nu comes out, and then it breaks up something or makes some recoil. You're not going to see this nu come out. Charge current, you got something more to work with. You've got, this is a new mu coming in, a muon coming out that you can easily detect. And then you still have this recoil. What happens here depends on the energy of your neutrino. So if you have very high energy neutrinos coming in, you can really get deep in elastic scattering and get some spectacular, weird, junky events. At lower energy, you do, you know, you're not doing much, and they can be really hard to detect, this recoil. One of the most important things is at low energy is actually inverse beta decay. Do I show a plot on that? I do not. But basically, you've got... the neutrino converting the neutron, converting the proton into a neutron and releasing an electron. So that's at low energy, and that's very important. But so those are the sorts of things you're looking at. If you have charge current, it's easy. It's either electron, depending on the flavor of the neutrino, electron, muon, or tau coming out. Neutral current's tougher. You're really depending on looking at this recoil. So types of detectors that we are. This is Super K right here. This is a very famous picture here. This is, I think this was after they had a big implosion of a bunch of PMTs, and they had to drain everything, fix everything, and then fill it back up. And this is somebody cleaning it in a boat. This gives you a scale. It's a big thing. It's 50 kilotons of water. What they do here is they're mostly sensitive to muon and electron neutrinos, so it comes in and interacts. The muon comes in, you get Cherenkov radiation as this relativistic particle goes through the water. Nu-Es are little, so that you just get a ring, you get a Cherenkov ring in your PMTs. The Nu-Es, they don't just go straight, they, you know, do things like start to shower and things like that, so you get like a fuzzy ring. But it is, and actually the fuzziness of the ring lets them discriminate from muons and electron neutrinos. And so that's Super K. This is snow actually right here, which is a ball of, right now, or actually in the past, I should say, they're changing things up a little bit. It's heavy water, which was very useful. And then Mini Boon is mineral oil plus scintillator, but this is sort of the Cherenkov light is a huge part of what a detector like Mini Boon does. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a second. Minos and Nova are long baseline detectors, both of them in Minnesota, and they both basically use the same sort of techniques. Minos basically alternates steel with some solid scintillator read out by PMTs, and then a lot of that. So your interaction typically happens in the steel, the high density steel, and then you track it downstream. Nova actually forgoes the steel and just has liquid scintillator. They have lots of layers of these liquid scintillator things, and they're channeled too as well. So this is just a lot of liquid scintillator, and it leaks, but that's not so bad. But so it looks like this. And so what you have here with the long baseline, your beam is coming this way. Minos is underground in the mine. Nova is actually on the surface. The neutrinos are coming this way, and then happen, let's say an interaction happens on this layer, and then you see what happens. You can sort of track it, and you measure its energy. And so this is actually a neutrino interaction from Nova. And so each point here is a light signal coming out from one of these channels. And there's different views because the different channels can give you different views. Okay.
So these are long.
Oh, these are long baseline experiments. So they're looking at neutrino oscillations. These are far away. The I'm going to go into it, but the beams are generated at Fermilab. So these, I'm not sure what the baseline is, but it's, you know, many hundreds of kilometers away. And then the other is like Dia Bay, which is basically just, you put a box or a bag somewhere with a bunch of scintillator, and you wait for a neutrino interaction, and the scintillator scintillates, and you read out the light. So it's a bunch of PMTs around. Instead of water, you use scintillator. These are really good for reactor neutrinos because you can get, the scintillator tends to put out a lot of light. These are low energy things, so. And then one nice thing about this inverse beta decay, you've got this neutron coming out, which typically you're not going to be able to catch, but you have, first of all, with organic scintillator, you have lots of protons, so this inverse beta decay is really important. If you don't have free protons, let's say in a liquid argon detector that I'm going to talk, this inverse beta decay doesn't happen. And then you can dope the scintillator with something like gadolinium, which actually will capture the neutron and then put out more light. So you can actually see two things. You can see the electron coming off, scintillating, and then this gadolinium gets captured. It captures the free neutron, and sometime later will put out something else. So that really helps you. Those two handles help you put down the background a lot, because these things are typically fairly close to the surface, so you have a lot of other cosmics coming in. Does that make sense? I mean, it's a lot of information. I don't expect you to become a neutrino physicist overnight, or even after 3 years, like me. okay, so there's one more important type of detector. I hope this doesn't sound like I'm like trying to sell the Fermilab program on you. It might sound like that after the next few slides. Okay, so when we talk about long baseline,
doesn't have the money to buy it anyways. So.
They'll be. It's going to be right in the heart of your careers, this LB&E, so, or Dune. Okay. I already talked about the key parameter for this neutrino oscillation is L over E. I'm supposed to include a plot of oscillations versus L over E. That was a comment to myself. I did. Oh, so that's what this is. Okay, this is hard. I'm going to go over this, but this is a plot from the LB&E TDR. So there are long baseline experiments. When long baseline, it's hundreds of kilometers or thousands of kilometers. And those are like Minos, Nova. I showed those detectors. Those are from Fermilab to Minnesota. And T-Dek is another experiment that the long baseline is actually running right now. It's from J-Park in Tokai in Japan to Kamioka, Kamiokande. They use that as the far detector. It's actually not a very long baseline. It's only a few hundred kilometers. But and then OPERA was another one that was looking at tau, looking at oscillations to tau neutrinos. I'm going to not go over any of these. I'm going to go over the next one that's coming, hopefully. And then there's also short baseline experiments, and these are for chasing a certain anomaly that we've heard a little bit about, or at least been mentioned a couple times, that was caused by LSND, not to blame them, but, you know, they've been a couple experiments trying to chase after that anomaly, so I'll talk about that too. What this plot shows is the baseline in kilometers, here's 1,000, 3,000 here at the end, versus the energy of the neutrino. And this is the oscillation probability for nu mu go to nu e, assuming normal hierarchy, delta CP equals zero, so no CP violation. And so this is what you see. So at 1300, this line is conveniently drawn, and energy of, this is one GeV, so this is probably three or four GeV, you get some oscillation probability. So this would be, if you have a nu mu beam, this is the probability that you'll see. If you have a nu mu starting at Fermilab, for instance, it's the probability that you'll see a nu E in 13 kilometers away, 1,300 kilometers away, okay? Now, you see that it varies with energy, right, L over E. So if you have a beam that's, you know, that has a beam energy, if you have a beam that has neutrino energies between, let's say, here and down here, you're going to be able to see two of these oscillation maxima. That's what their term does. Now, as you go lower and lower energies, these things get closer and closer together. Yes, sir?
Is there ever a regime where it's dangerous to only consider two neutrino flavors in these terms? Or do they always just sit in a place where they're only going to see one type of oscillation?
So this is not considering. This is the probability that it oscillates into. So they're not.
But they're assuming the two-body formula for these.
This doesn't assume that. This is the, you can calculate the probability, right? Yeah, but right. But when you do fits to oscillation, if you're looking at something like electron nu e disappearance, for instance, you really have to include everything, right? I mean, because it can disappear into different things. So that's right, absolutely.
But it is true that two distances are separated by about a factor of 10. So it's a first order group.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yes, sir.
The dependence seems to be L and square root of E, so I'm a little confused about that. Shouldn't it depend on L over E?
Sorry, what's that? I don't know. Say that again.
Shouldn't these things depend on the ratio of L over E? So won't there be straight lines on that?
It's a sign of that's right. Yeah. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about how you make a neutrino beam. This has been very well established for 10, 15 years now. So what they do is they take a proton beam, Fermilab, CERN, wherever. They have some target, and this is an intense proton beam, so the target is very complicated to keep it from melting down and causing an environmental disaster. This thing produces lots of pions and some kaons, and depending on the energy of this, could produce, you know, D mesons and things like that. The pions and kaons especially will travel through a focusing horn, which is meant to basically make everything point in the right direction. And you can actually charge select on this horn, so you can select positive or negative pions, for instance, and that will charge select or, you know, select nus from nu bars. There's a decay pipe, and then at the end of the decay pipe, you'll have, so all the pions will decay away, you'll have some muons, you'll have some neutrinos, and then there's an absorber to get rid of the muons, and you'll have just neutrinos, mostly nu mus from the pion decays, and also from the muon decays. You'll have some nu e's, but they're sort of a contamination. So you have a fairly pure nu mu beam coming out at the end of the day, pointed towards hopefully where you want it to be, which is tricky because where you want it to be, where you want to detect it is 1,000 kilometers away. So you have to be fairly precise. Fortunately, there's some divergence to the beam. Does that make sense? Okay, so here's an example of the NUMMI beam, which is neutrinos at the main injector at Fermilab. Yes, sir.
Is CERN hot from this kind of neutrino direction? Would that greatly improve the experiment? Do you get a little more protons, or is that another thing?
So I don't know that they have, I would not say that they have a lot more protons. I mean, Fermilab has the most intense proton driver right now.
Oh, okay.
So they have higher energy protons, that's for sure. But the NUMMI beam, the main injector beam is 120 GeV protons, and it's megawatt, not quite, 800 kilowatt, which is the highest right now. So so they use their 120 GeV protons for this. And what comes out, this is the neutrino spectrum that comes out. So, and I think this is sort of, there's a big spray of neutrinos coming out. And then if you say, what's the spectrum at Minos, which is 1,000 kilometers away or, you know, close to that, this is what they see, okay? Now, and so you see that the mean is around 7 GeV, or the peak here is around 7 GeV. Starting with 120 GeV, so you know, to get really high one high neutrino energy, you really have to have a really high beam. But that's actually not the most interesting thing. The NOVA experiment is a little bit off axis, 14 milliradians to be precise, and this is the beam they see. You see, this is a lot tighter. The spread in the beam energies is a lot less. This is actually the reason NOVA is sitting there, so that they don't have to worry about. They know their neutrino energy. They don't have to worry about really reconstructing it. So they know exactly how many, because as you saw, the oscillation position depends on the neutrino energy. But they know exactly where they sit, right here at basically 2 GeV. They know exactly how many they should see oscillating into new E's. So that's the idea. For NOVA, that's the idea for, this is called off-axis experiment. It just makes, so Minos is basically sitting right in the middle of the neutrino beam. NOVA is 14 milliradians off of the axis of the neutrino beam. So they're getting like the halo of the neutrino beam, if you say, but it has a very definite energy that of the neutrinos that come in there. Okay, so that's basically, so these are going on right now. Minos is actually just wrapping up. They might have a second run. NOVA's going on right now. We don't have results from them yet. But we're already thinking about the future, and that is, and the future of high energy physics in America, is the Dune experiment at LBNF at SURF. That's what I'm going to call it. That's a good name, I think. So the goal of this, we need to get the mass hierarchy. We need to get CP violating phase in the neutrino sector. Current experiments are definitely not going to do this. They might be able to do this. And then we also need to just take another step in the precision of the other parameters. Salesmanship, the international community is come together for Dune. Some of this is wishful thinking. But okay, so let me define what these things mean. Dune is the detector. And the detector is going to be 40 kiloton of liquid argon TPC. I'm going to explain what those acronyms mean in a second. I think it stands for Detector of Underground Neutrinos Experiment. And it refers to the collaboration, including the near and far detector. LBNF is the cavern holding the detector and the beam. The beam will be upgraded actually from the current beam. It's gonna be a little more powerful. And then SURF is the lab where the cavern is. And SURF is the Stanford Underground Research Facility. Okay? There may be some references into something called LBNE. I may say LBNE. That's somebody else talking. All right? LBNE does not exist. Okay, so this is, the people at Fermilab have really made some really nice pictures for this. So this is Fermilab. Fermilab's in Chicago. Does everyone know that? Batavia. It's a long ways from Chicago, actually. But there's an existing proton accelerator there. They're going to build a beam, a new neutrino line, and produce neutrinos. There's going to be a near detector. Why do you have a near detector? Does anybody know why you would have a near detector?
To know your flux.
There you go. To know your flux. Study your composition of nuis in the thing. And also, there's actually a lot of physics you can do with, you know, sitting behind a really intense proton. So you can imagine doing a beam dump experiment and looking for light dark matter, for instance. Then at the Sanford Underground Research Facility, which is actually a mine that's been shut down for a long time in Homestake, South Dakota, that's done a lot of, over the years, has done a lot of physics and it's going to be doing even more physics in the next few years, we'll put this big liquid argon TPC. We're going to build a new cavern.
So Don and Misha maybe point out that this is not drawn to scale. For those who have not seen Fermilab before, it's not a kilometer high.
Okay, and so this is what they're going to do at Fermilab to make the beam. They're going to take it from the main injector, which is, again, this 120 GeV proton beam. They're going to split it off, and they're going to put it into this production hall right here. There's an absorber hall. I think this is to just to measure the. I'm not sure what the absorber hall actually is. And then deep underground, this thing's got to be pointing down, or else you're going to be irradiating Batavia and the Illinois prairie in a really bad way. And also you need to point down because you're going so far, and right there, this curved. So you got to, if you want to point it at the detector, the far detector, you have to do that. And so the near detector actually has to be fairly far in the ground. Why is there this hump here? Because if there wasn't a hump here and you started going down here, you'd be really far down and it's expensive to dig. And so the main tune that we'll probably use is this blue tune here, which is roughly the same beam profile, a little bit broader than Minos. Actually, we go down to Jev. So. Okay, I gotta hurry up if you're gonna have lunch today. So I just show this because if you're familiar with Fermilab, this is Kirk Road. This is Wilson Hall here. This is like the main gate. It comes very close to Kirk Road. Very, very close. And actually we would like to put it on this side, but there's houses here. So the neighbors wouldn't like that, I think. Okay, so this is I told you, they made a lot of nice pictures. So this is SURF and LBNF. This is in Homestake, South Dakota. It's very close to Sturgis. So once a year, this town of like a few hundred people is invaded by a bunch of leather-clad motorcyclists. But, okay, so this is SURF. There are a couple shafts in this mine with historical names. What do I want to say about this? Where's Albini? Albini is right here. That's right, exactly. So that was run by Davis. What was his first name?
Ray
Davis. That's right. So this Davis campus this is where it was. And so there's actually a bunch of other experiments that are slated to go in there. Lux is probably the big one, which is Lux LZ, which is going to be the next generation. Dark matter, xenon dark matter detector. But there's a bunch of other stuff going in too. And LBNE is going to sit right there, or Dune. I'm sorry, Dune is going to sit right here. This down here, this is 4850 feet from the top, so it's almost a mile down. And what we're going to put in there is this. It's a system of four cryostats, each one that's going to hold 10 kilotons of liquid argon. That's fiducial volume, actually, so it's going to be more than that. But in these cryostats, we're going to put a series of wire planes, TPCs, in this sort of design. So this APA is actually the wire plane, and the CPA is, so the APA stands for anode plane assembly. CPA stands for cathode plane assembly. So you have your APA, your CPA, you put a big bias between the two. I'll show you how it works in a second. So I'll show you how it works in a second. So we're going to have three of these readout planes. And so what you're seeing here, the neutrino beam is coming this way. And so you've got basically these four different detector volumes. And so these are basically going all the way down one of these things. Now, I don't know if you can see a scale here. Sometimes they show a catwalk. But yeah, you can't see a person on this. I mean, if they put a person on next to this, it would be a little speck on this. It's really, really, really big. I'm sorry, the neutrinos are coming this way. Going this way.
And then this is a section.
And so this is a cross section this way. That makes sense.
Yeah, so the particles are parallel to the electric field. The beams are parallel to the electric field.
Perpendicular.
Coming into the board.
Yeah. That's right. Right. Yeah, exactly. Your wires are on a plane going in and out of the board. Here, this maybe next one is a little better.
Green is the argon?
Green is the argon, yeah. Yes, green is the, I'm sorry, this is, the argon is here. And then this outside here is your cryostat that keeps everything cold.
I thought anode and cathode sets up the electric field lines in the.
That's right, exactly. So, a particle go through, and the electrons, the ionization electrons, will drift this way. Yeah.
And the beams are coming orthogonal.
That's right. The beam on this picture here is going orthogonal. That's right, into it. That's right. Sorry, there was confusion there. Okay. So this is what happens. So now in this case, again, the beam is going, well, sort of this way. Okay. A neutrino comes in. Not sure what's going on in this picture, but I know what's going on, but I think a neutrino comes in, interacts right here. I'm not sure why it's pronging. It's maybe a decay here. So like this, a neutrino interacts here, you get something coming out, and then maybe something else. Maybe it decays. If it's a charged particle, it can decay. And as it's going along here, it's going to ionize the argon. So it's going to leave a bunch of electrons along these lines. These lines are charged particles. The electric field is going, the drift is going this way. I'm sorry. The electric field is going this way. The electrons are going to go this way, collected on these planes of wires, okay? And so right after this happens, they will start drifting, and it takes order of milliseconds for them, depending on how far they are, to drift to the wires. On the wires, you're measuring out the current constantly. And so there's three sets of wires here, so you can get three different views, so you can do a real reconstruction. What else should we say about this? So this is actually showing what you're reading out as a function of time on the y-axis, because time, in this case, is sort of a spatial coordinate. If you measure out something that comes earlier than something else, you can say that it started closer to the plane. Does that make sense? Sort of. Takes a little while to get your head around how TPCs work, but time in a TPC is basically another spatial direction. Okay, so then they can make some really nice plots.
And then what's the time zero, so you know exactly where.
I didn't want to get into it, but liquid argon is also an excellent scintillator. And the scintillation light, so this takes milliseconds. The scintillation light is prompt, and it just goes through. And so you get, they're in between these wire planes, or actually in between, after the wire planes, sort of reading in between the wire planes, are scintillating paddles that will take the scintillation light. I'm sorry, they're not scintillating paddles. They're paddles that have PMTs attached to them, which will take the scintillation light and read it out and give you basically a T0. So this thing came in at, T equals 2 seconds, and then 3 milliseconds later, you'll start reading out your wires. So that gives you a start time for the event.
So this is the essence of a time projection chip. The electrons drift, the path eventually drifts over to the anode where it's collected, and the time that the collection occurs tells you exactly where that path is.
That's right.
It's an incredibly beautiful image.
That's right. But if you just have the collection wire times, there's some ambiguities whether something happened close to the wire plane, a long time, or something happened, or two things happen. If two things happen at the same time, right? You could have something that happened at a later time, but close to the wire plane that can arrive at the same time as something happened earlier, but far away from the wire plane. So you need this T0 to differentiate that.
I point out the regular detection experiments today, the xenon, essentially that sort of concept.
That's exactly right.
Scintillation at the time for the zero, then the ionization charge gets collected. It's not TPC, but it's not too.
That's right. Yes, sir.
But since you brought up direct detection, something that I think from a few slides ago was slide 33, just the shaft.
Yes.
So you have this thing where you're detecting a beam of neutrinos.
Yes.
And you're setting this up somewhere close to a direct detection experiment. Won't they be pissed about the backgrounds
of our neutrinos are a lot higher energy. I mean,
I was really hoping you're going to say, oops.
I would say, screw them, whatever. Not my experiment. No, these are a lot higher energy. These are going to be kicking off electrons and nuclei at many, many MeV. I don't think they're going to have a problem. There's also a timing structure to the beams, the spill structure they call it, so that they'll be able to cross check whether if they see some events there, they'll be able to say, oh, well, it might be a neutrino event. Also, each spill, the probability for a neutrino interaction for each spill, there are lots of reasons here. The probability in the huge liquid argon detector, we might get one neutrino interaction every 10 spills or so. So you can imagine a dark matter detector that's orders of magnitude smaller, they're not going to really see anything. And screw them. Okay, so this is cool. So this is a fake neutrino event from Monte Carlo from Microboon. What they're seeing here is a fake neutrino coming in, interacting, electron neutrino, charge current, the electron comes in, you see all this hairy stuff as it's showering, and then you also see a proton come out. And the color here is how much charge each one is, or how much ionization energy each particle is coming through. And you see this electron is sort of bluish, whereas the proton's hard to see, is very red. It's putting out more energy per unit distance. And so with that, you can also use this for particle ID. You can measure the total charge of this thing as an estimate of the energy of it. So this is really a tracking calorimeter with particle ID built in. It's really a beautiful thing. This is Monte Carlo, of course. This is actually data. I like the color scheme of this one a little better, but this is actually from a small experiment called Argonaut, which was really mostly a test bed experiment. And so what you see here is a neutrino coming in, and I'm not sure exactly what's going on here, but you see some tracks coming out. This looks like probably a proton because of the high DDX. You see something coming in here. This is probably a photon from somewhere, traveling for a certain distance and then converting. It's beautiful. This was in a magnetic field. That's why you see some curvature here. I think this was very, very soft. And so these are actually two different views. This is the collection wire plane, the induction wire plane. Don't worry about what those means. But you know, since you've got in our case, three different views, you're going to have different views of this. And you need to put them together in three dimensions. Each wire plane gives you two dimensions, time and whatever. And so you need to put the different views into a three-dimensional reconstruction. And it's very difficult, actually. It's the one thing that we work on. Yes, sir?
Maybe that's in the beginning, but what is the goal of this whole project?
Okay, I'm going to get into that in a second. Okay. I'm still talking about detectors. I'm still in this sort of... Okay, so here we go, actually. The goal is to see neutrino oscillations, right? It's L over E producing, we have a neutrino beam coming in. And the golden mode here is looking for new E appearing. That's really thing. But we'll also look for new taus. And so the measure, the goal is to measure the oscillation spectrum. So this is the new mu spectrum of the beam at LBNE. I'm sorry, at Dune, at the Dune detector, 1,300 kilometers away. So that's in black, and that's what this axis corresponds to. Okay, so the number of events, number of charge current events per some crazy combination of numbers. What's shown on the y-axis is the appearance probability. So it only goes to 20% here. For different values of theta 1/3, sine squared theta 1/3, and the CP violating phase. And as you see, they're very different. And so that's the idea. You have, this is your sort of parent spectrum, and you look at new E appearance, charge, and in the charge current, you basically look for an electron coming in, nothing coming in, an electron in your TPC. And based on the spectrum of that, you can measure the energy because it's a calorimeter. You see what you get as a function of energy. And if you see something like the green, you can say, oh, theta 1/2 must be 0.1, and delta CP must be pi over 2. Does that make sense? And so that, you know, and based on how these oscillation, how you see this oscillation pattern, and we'll see what you'll see in the second, we'll definitely see this first oscillation, but we'll also see a little bit of a blip for the second oscillation. So depending on how this oscillation pattern looks in the far detector, we'll be able to fit this to the three oscillation probability and extract delta CP. That's the goal.
And you do it with both neutrinos
and antineutrinos. That's right, exactly. So this is actually just the neutrino spectrum, but this is how we expect the reconstructed spectrum to look, given some size of detector and number of years, 3 years in neutrino mode. And so you see, with delta CP equals 0, you expect this. With different values of delta CP, you expect more or less. This is for the normal hierarchy. For the inverted hierarchy, things are a lot different. And actually, if you're only running in neutrino mode, it's actually really hard to tell, let's say, delta CP equals minus 90. That's this gray thing here. In the normal hierarchy with the inverted hierarchy with no CP violation. It's actually not, or actually with delta CP equals 90, especially, right? So that's why you run in anti-neutrino mode. I don't have plots for that, but you should see the opposite sort of interference pattern there. So you can get the neutrino spectrum, I'm sorry, you can get the CP violation and the mass hierarchy through this. I mean, it's possible that we'll already know the mass hierarchy. It's one number, right? So I mean, we don't need 1,000 experiments to see it. So that might just be an input into the fits, but. So this is actually, let's say it's not discovered yet. This is the reach that we expect to get given, I think, 3 years of running in both modes. So 6 years of running total. And this is delta chi squared, so the square root of delta chi squared. So this is basically sigma. So this is 5 sigma. This is really a standard thing. And this is the sensitivity that you get as a function for the mass hierarchy, saying it's definitely inverted or it's definitely normal. As a function of delta CP. It really depends on delta CP. I already sort of illustrated that before. And so you really want to get 5 sigma, 3 sigma is probably okay. But if you just have Dune, you get something like this, you don't do a very good job at delta CP equals, delta CP is at 0.5 over pi, but you do on the other side. If you add information from other experiments, in this case, TDK and NOVA, which have probably be done by then and have some information, we can actually get some information here. The reason this looks weird is because TDK only runs in new mode. They don't have a new bar beam that they can produce. So this is sensitivity. For normal hierarchy, it's sort of flipped for inverted hierarchy. So, but we'll see it. I mean, it probably will already be discovered. What I think is going to be more interesting for Dune is measuring the CP phase. And this is how the evolution of the CP phase will go. Our uncertainty right now is up here at 50 some degrees. As LBNE takes data, and including the Dune data as well. After 5 years, we'll get down to something like, depending on what the value is of delta CP, 15 degrees or 10 degrees, and that. And then as you go further, 20 years, it starts to flatten out a little bit. So I give here the uncertainty on beta, although I already showed the uncertainty on delta CKM. It's about five. It's a few degrees. I would say it's, you know, I think delta CKM now at this point is about 3 degrees. So it's going to take forever to get there. We're probably going to need a new experiment to get to that level. But do you really need that level for this? Well, this is going to be a very good step. So the plan, just in case you're interested in joining the collaboration, there's been a lot of reconfiguration, as you can imagine. We're doing a CD1 right now. If you don't know what a CD1 is, then congratulations, you're a lucky person. But LBNF, the facility, is going into CD3 later. And what CD3 means is you get money and you can start building things, doing construction, and that means taking rock out of the cavern. And so we expect to start doing that in 2018, probably 2017, 2018. Actually start excavating the cavern. There's a lot of work that has to be done before we can actually start hauling rock up, but this will be very good. 2012 for the first cryosat installation, and then first data taking with that first 10 kiloton cryostat in probably 2023. The nice thing about having 4 cryostat is you can build them sequentially, and while you're taking data with the first one, you can build the second one. So there are a lot of hopes here, but things are looking up. Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God. I think you guys are out of luck with the short baseline stuff. I mean, not really out of luck, but yeah, I think I better skip the short baseline. And that's where the interesting new physics is, but it's probably not real, so don't worry about it.
Take 2 minutes and
talk.
Okay. What do you think is the interesting thing about it?
Oh, geez. There's so much. Oh.
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay, so. So basically, the short baseline anomaly, which you've heard a few times now, is two experiments now have taken data at an L over E, very different from what you would expect to see neutrino oscillations at. LSND, do I show what the... Mini Boon is sort of a GeV neutrino energy at a very short baseline, 500 meters from the beam. And what they see when they measure the neutrino, reconstructed neutrino energy, both in neutrino and nu bar, is an excess of events at low reconstructed neutrino energy. And so this is, again, a muon neutrino beam, and this is, they're measuring electron neutrino appearance. And so there are a bunch of backgrounds here, but they see more, again, they see more than they think they should. You can see they've done a lot of studies for backgrounds. The LSND, which was the earlier experiment, saw an excess at this value of, sort of in between this value of L over E. So the agreement's not great, but as you see here in the this is the LSND. This is the LSND, I think. The blue is LSND. It's not a terrible agreement. So what is this? Microboon is an experiment that's just coming online right now, a liquid argon TPC. And the nice thing about that is, compared to the older experiments, which were mineral oil, bags, they can't really tell electrons from photons. Liquid argon TPCs can do this extremely well. So here's that first plot again. Basically, what you see here is an interaction coming in, some photons coming out, probably actually 2 photons, a pi zero, and then you see the electrons start to shower, and there's probably another photon coming in here and giving some. So this separation between the primary vertex and secondary vertices give you electron versus gamma separation. And so they're going to do two analyses. They're going to do one where they look for electron-like things and one for where they do photon-like things. And if they see the excess on the electron-like things, then that might be neutrino oscillations. If it's photon-like things, it could be that we just don't understand the nuclear physics going on well enough. You're seeing new mu, probably neutral current, new mu scattering with a photon coming off the proton or something. So that's the idea. If they see something in the gamma-like channel, it's probably nothing. If they see something in an electron-like channel, it could be something. So we'll stay tuned. That's going to be a couple years now. They're just putting stuff in the... They're just putting liquid argon. I think they've just did it like 2 weeks ago, put liquid argon in the cryostat. So. Okay, so that's all. You get 5 minutes late. Okay.
So
this was good. It was a good collaborative talk.
That was great.
Thanks for the corrections.
So we do have a couple of minutes for questions. Don't be too impatient with lunch. This is more important than food. So any good questions?
Yes. Oh, whoever.
Sorry.
Okay.
In the detector, especially supercomputing, how they can visualize some neutrinos from other sources, especially radioactive elements in the rock?
Well, those radioactive sources are much lower energy, right? And the radioactives are new are electron neutrinos, right? They're not muon neutrinos. So if you see, they can tell an electron, a charge current electron neutrino event as the electron comes off for, pretty well because of the fuzziness of the rings, the Cherenkov rings, because you get more multiple scattering, you get and you get little mini showers that come off through the electrons. But the muons are just basically dead straight, and you get a very clean Cherenkov ring in your PMTs. So they can do it. And again, the radioactive stuff is very low energy.
Is there any outer baseline for these detectors?
I'm sorry?
Is there any outer baseline, outer detector
for these? Oh, like a Vito?
Yeah.
Not for Super K. Part of the problem is Super K is huge. I mean, and you'd have to have a huge...
But the fiducial volume is inside the walls. So you can tell whether a muon originates inside that.
Oh, well, that's right. Yeah, exactly.
So, how many people know what the term fiducial volume is?
Oh.
Okay, yeah. So, typically in the detector, you have the whole detector volume. And then you define some sub-volume inside, which is called the fiducial volume. Your experiment is looking for only events in that subvolume. So a muon that comes in through the walls will have a track that's outside the fiducial volume. And then it goes inside and then it goes outside. So then you can tell that it came from outside rather than originating inside. And so all that is part of the event. So a cosmic ray neutrino, for example, will come all the way through. And you can tell that.
Have people thought about recycling the Big Bang detector for dark matter as well? Like about different regimes for dark matter?
There's definitely talk. I mean, that's recycling. I mean, it's a huge detector. We're going to spend billions of dollars on it. Yeah, there's people thinking about doing different sorts of dark matter stuff. Our thresholds are maybe 2 MeV.
Argon is problematic.
It's got like an endpoint of half an MeV or something for that. There actually is an experiment called Darkside who's going to use depleted argon, which means that it doesn't have very much radioactive impurities. I think the radioactive impurities came from the nuclear testing, right? And so this argon was found deep in a well, and it hasn't seen the light of.
The impurities are cosmically activated.
Oh, the impurities are cosmic. Okay. Okay.
So they come from underground.
There we go.
Where they're produced by reactive decay underground and shielded from cosmic rays.
Right. Okay. Cool. Thank you. So yes, people are thinking you're using. I mean, they are using, but very special kind of argon, not the stuff you pump from the air.
Now if you're interested in GeV energies or 100 MeV energies, then argon is just fine.
Yeah.
And the more the better. still also do, for example, prevalent research.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some, yeah, it's not just looking at long baseline stuff. It's, you can't build a detector like this with one physics goal, like five physics goals. And hopefully more. That's your guys' job. That's your exercise, is to think of more ways to get physics out of this huge 40 kiloton tracking calorimeter.